We're talking with David Marler, who, as you can tell, is an excellent guest who knows his stuff. Here's a little roadmap for the upcoming hour, what we're going to do. We'll wrap up our conversation about this astounding Farmington UFO armada, then segue into David's definitive work on triangular UFOs. He wrote the best book that I've read on this little slice of the UFO mystery, and I was amazed to learn how far back the triangular sightings reach. Those of you who suggest that the mystery triangles are some sort of secret Pentagon project will have a hard time explaining some of the cases that David has uncovered. We'll get into that momentarily on Coast to Coast AM. David, before we move on from the Farmington case, is there anything else that I've overlooked and haven't asked you about that you'd like to convey? And is there some place that our audience can read the research that you've done in it?
Absolutely, George. One thing I'd like to touch on is, you know, beyond what my personal thoughts are on this case, I want to reference Dr. Lincoln LaPaz, who we mentioned, that was investigating the green fireball sightings at this time. In the Farmington Daily Times, March 25th, he was actually quoted. They were inquiring about what he thought about this incident. And, you know, Dr. Lincoln LaPaz was an extremely grounded, objective scientist. He was not a wide-eyed believer in UFOs by any means. But he said in reference to, you know, his opinion on the sightings of a mass flight of saucers over Farmington, he said it belongs in the, quote, quite serious class, unquote. And then Dr. James McDonald, who I referenced, who had conducted interviews and collected a lot of information with regard to the Navy Skyhook balloons, as we mentioned, in a letter to Johnny Eaton, who was one of the primary witnesses in Farmington at the time, he says, from all the interviews I now have and other information bearing on that case, it seems to me to be a rather significant event. And again, James McDonald was, you know, no fool. He was extremely objective. He tried to find practical explanations. And for, you know, someone of his scientific caliber to make that statement, I think that speaks volumes.
James McDonald is an heroic and tragic figure in UFO history. I think, you know, he's been forgotten by a lot of the people who are new to the subject, but gosh, what a giant he was.
Yeah, he is one of those researchers historically that I hold in highest regard. I think he's done a tremendous amount of credible research. And for anyone that's interested in learning more about James McDonald, his archives, and I've been there, that's how I secured copies of his notes on this case, the University of Arizona in Tucson, I always like to give them a shout out. They have all of his written materials. In other words, you can go through his original handwritten notes, and you can also listen to the hundreds of hours of interviews which he recorded on reel-to-reel recordings, which the university, after his death, digitized. And so, tremendous amount of historical data there for anybody that's interested.
Not to get too far off the track, but his death, suspicious at all? Certainly tragic. He
it's
was subjected tragic. To so much ridicule, right?
Yeah, he was, and it's tragic, and I know a lot of people try to read in, you know, some type of malevolent, you know, undertaking on the part of government to basically, you know, remove him from the UFO scene, but he really had a tragic life. You know, his marriage was falling apart. He suffered from depression. He was receiving, no surprise, a lot of criticism and pressure from his scientific colleagues for looking at the UFO subject and being so vocal about it. And, you know, without going into too much detail, before he did commit suicide, he actually had a failed suicide attempt just weeks before. And so, you know, the writing was on the wall, unfortunately. It was a tragic end to an incredible life. And, you know, he was cut short. And I just think what other research and work could he have contributed to the field if he had lived longer?
I do also want to mention about Lincoln LaPaz. So the study of the green fireballs was called Project Twinkle, and that document was released. I remember reading it when I first got involved in this, and I think people can probably find that on their website.
Absolutely.
Online.
And in reference to the Farmington research, as you mentioned, George, my website has a page, and it's devoted to the Farmington investigation. I don't have the latest file that we've just discovered added to that yet, but if anybody's interested in reading more, they can go to my website and read about the Farmington incident.
Moving on to triangular UFOs, your book, Triangular UFOs, An Estimate of the Situation, if students of the history of ufology will recognize the how clever that that phrase is as part of the title.
Absolutely. Yeah, the famous estimate of the situation was one of the earliest reports drafted by Air Force personnel in the very early stages of Project Sign. And it's kind of become legendary in the sense that, you know, all copies were ordered destroyed by General Hoyt Vandenberg. But I liken my book to that report in the sense that, in military parlance, an estimate of the situation is often the subtitle of a report on, say, a military cargo plane crash or some type of military incident. And so I wanted to kind of frame it along those lines because I really did try to write this as if I was presenting this to government officials as a formal report, a true estimate of the situation as it pertains to one particular subset of UFOs, namely triangular UFOs.
In your book, we get a little of a biographical hint about how you got hooked on this topic. You were 5 years old in 1973?
Yeah,
I think that's how old I was in 1973, obviously.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. And you know, George, as you know, in the 70s, UFOs were pretty prevalent in on TV and on news news segments and in the newspapers still at the time. But yeah, that's actually the first time I ever remember hearing the term of UFO being coined, and it was by my late father. In 1973, there was a wave of UFO sightings around Piedmont, Missouri, which is to the southeast of St. Louis, Missouri, which is the area we lived at the time. And there was a recent series of sightings, and it originally started with the local basketball coach and basketball team members coming back from another neighboring town where they had lost the basketball game. And they were coming back, and they saw this series of lights, and it was highly unusual. And just like any wave or localized period of activity, it usually starts with one sighting. Well, that was the initial sighting that then basically launched a series of subsequent reports in that area. The basketball coach, his name was Reggie Bone, and I remember my dad at the time saying, well, if Reggie said he saw something, you can take it to the bank. The reason he said that was one of his best friends growing up when he lived in that area growing up before he moved to the St. Louis area. And so he and my older siblings were piling in the car on weekends to go down to Piedmont to, quote unquote, look for UFOs. And a lot of people in the St. Louis community were doing that as well because it had garnered a lot of newspaper and television coverage. And so my father was going down there with thermoses of coffee and binoculars, and they would always come home. They made several trips that year down to Piedmont because my father's aunt and uncle lived down there for many years then and then decades later even. And they never did see anything, but they did talk to people, police officers and other witnesses that had seen lights or unusual objects. And so that was my initial introduction to the UFO subject. And then 4 years after that, 1977, my sister and her husband had a close encounter with a UFO outside Kansas City, Missouri, where I hate to say it, George, but it's the best analogy I can use. It was like Roy Neary out of Close Encounters, where they come to a stop sign and all of a sudden there's a spotlight that's illuminating the car, the road around them, and buildings that were in the area. This was around midnight in the summer of 77. And my sister was asleep, and she woke up with her husband punching her very vigorously in the arm, saying, wake up, wake up. You got to see this. Wake up. And her first thought, George, as she opened her eyes, because she knew they left St. Louis around 7, they were going to get in around midnight, her first thought as she opens her eyes is, why is it daylight outside? It had literally lit up the area around the car. There was no noise. There was no wind disturbance, so it wasn't a police helicopter with a spotlight. It wasn't anything conventional. Her husband actually looked out the driver's side window and tried to look at whatever the source of the light was. All he could see was an array of lights in addition to this very large bright white light that was shining down. And then just as soon as it appeared, it was, and we hear this so often, don't we, in UFO literature and cases, it was like suddenly a light switch was flipped and it was gone. And so, I used to hear that always discussed at Thanksgiving and Christmas gatherings of family. People would say, well, tell us about that UFO sighting you had in 1977. And then a year after that, there was another wave of UFO sightings just north of St. Louis in an area called Ellsbury, Missouri. And they had UFO sightings, cattle mutilations, and again, it had garnered a lot of attention. So I always like to say I never had a sighting of my own that launched my interest in the subject, but it was just a successive series of events growing up that just, you know, really reinforced and solidified my interest in the subject.
And you describe yourself in this book as an open-minded skeptic, which is, I would assume, is still the case, meaning
Absolutely.
You are open-minded to wherever the evidence leads you. It is a genuine mystery, but you're not
Absolutely.
Willing to go as far as saying these craft are from the planet Krypton.
No, not absolutely. And you know, I've always appreciated your journalism with regard to the subject over the years, George, because, you know, I always say it doesn't matter what you believe regarding the UFO subject. It only matters what the data reflects. And, you know, because otherwise then we're going down the rabbit holes of conspiracies and other crazy ideas. What does the evidence show? And so that is really kind of my mission statement, if you will, in collecting a lot of this historical material, trying to draw from as many data points as I can worldwide over decades. And that really describes how my book on triangular UFOs was written. It's really looking at a wide cross-section of a very specific subset of UFO reports, these triangular UFOs.
So let's transition to those. You do have some numbers in the book. I didn't realize that, you know, as a subset of UFO shapes that have been reported, that triangles would be as prominent as they are. Can you give us sort of a basic idea of where they rank?
Absolutely. Well, over the last 20 to 30 years, we've seen a huge increased frequency of sightings. And in fact, Cheryl Costa is a great researcher that's done a lot of statistical work on these various UFO reports over the decades. And she, in her book, actually outlines a lot of the statistics from 2001 to 2015. And just to give your audience kind of a sample, in 2001, there were 395 reports on file based on the data set she looked at. In 2015, there were 1,051. And between those two data points, it basically is this linear progression and an increase in sightings of these things. But as you alluded to earlier, this is not, and I have to emphasize this, this is not a modern shift in UFO reporting. There are ample hundreds of triangular UFO reports going back to the 1950s and 1960s, not just triangular objects. Triangular objects with the same light patterns, the same flight characteristics, and that was really the impetus for the book. I had seen a lot of chatter on the internet, George, where people are saying, well, these triangles are new, therefore they must be military. And I'm sitting here looking at newspaper accounts that I had at the time, and even now, where, for example, there's one right here from Camarillo, California, dated November 14th, 1957. The article title is, Not Flying Saucer, But Flying Triangle, Seen by Local Residents, 1957. And then I have another one from the Pennsylvania area, Hazleton, Pennsylvania, again, 1957 in November, and it says, Reports Cite Flying Triangle Over City. And the articles just go on and on and on. Not just newspaper articles, though, but again, going through the British Ministry of Defense UFO files, as well as Air Force Project Blue Book files, there's numerous triangular UFO reports, not just here in the United States, but overseas in Europe as well.
I think you've got, as I recall, you have a case going back to the 1880s?
Yes. Admittedly, as we go back further in time, it's hard to verify or corroborate some of these, but Scientific American, yes, 1882, they had an article where astronomers in out east, I believe it was Connecticut, were looking at the moon. And as they were observing the moon, they described seeing two dark triangular notches traversing the lower half of the moon. And so in 1882, what could that possibly be? And so, again, the details are sketchy the further you go back in time, but we don't just have to go back to that. We can go back to the 1940s and 1950s, and we see reports of these objects being very large and being described as silent, the same lighting patterns. In fact, there's a newspaper account from 1960 that shows the triangular object that we're familiar with today, a point of light in each point of the triangle and a red light in the center. And just recently I stumbled across, going through this latest set of files I acquired, Baltimore, Maryland, August 22nd, 1964, the report goes on to state that they saw a triangle, and they have a sketch of an equilateral triangle in the report. It goes on to state, at each corner, there was a bright white light, the well-defined shape of a triangle as drawn and noted. In the middle of the object and beneath was a small red light. And then it says there was no sound, uppercase letters typed in the report, no sound whatsoever. Goes on to state it was flying between 200 to 150 miles per hour, no more, in parentheses, and flying at less than 5,000 feet altitude. These are all characteristics that we hear of modern-day triangular UFO reports, yet this was reported in 1964, and that's just one of hundreds that I've been able to track down in the historical record.
I wanted to mention as a side note, last weekend we had as our guests on the program two filmmakers from the UK, the Penturk incident, something that happened in 2016 in Wales. It starts with, according to witnesses, a single red light. Then it grows into three red lights, then a gigantic red light ringed, not only a triangle, but a pyramid. So if you're not familiar with the case, it's something you're going to check out.
Yeah, I'll definitely have to look into that one. There's so many that are actually in the historical record, but you know, as you can appreciate, George, in the early days, most of the reports were the ubiquitous flying saucer, but intermixed with that, there's this underpinning of these triangular objects that are in the literature. It's just a matter of locating them. And as I said, we have government documents, we have newspaper accounts. I think it's important to note, just as we often do with UFO reports in general, not all of these are just eyewitness reports. In the Ministry of Defense files, as well as Project Blue Book, there's a number of accounts where there was radar confirmation in addition to the eyewitness testimony. And I always love to emphasize that because I think that's extremely important. There was a case over Albany, Georgia, January 28, 1953, where in Project Blue Book files, the pilot, a military pilot was on a solo mission. He saw this circular light up above him, and he noticed that it seemed to be extremely brilliant in intensity. He thought it might be a star or planet, but in the report he stated it had a very, very sharply defined circular shape to it. It wasn't scintillating like a star or a planet. So he decided, I'll increase altitude. Within a matter of seconds, if it's something within the atmosphere, it should close and it should start looking larger. If it's a star or a planet, it's not going to change perspective very much. Shortly after he increased altitude, he suddenly realized the light that was above him was now below him. And this is detailed in Project Blue Book files in great detail. He then decides to then descend and try to close on the object because obviously it's something within the atmosphere. In the Project Blue Book report, he states that the object then started alternating from white to orange, and then in the report he states the light morphed into a triangle, which then seconds later divided into two triangles, which then disappeared. Now, as if that's not crazy enough, I mean, and this is in the military's own files, the Albany, Georgia airport stated they were tracking a primary target at the same time and location of the pilot sighting.
I should point out that you have three chapters where you trace the historical cases that suggest that this has been going on a long time all over the world. In your book, Triangular UFOs, An Estimate of the Situation. We're going to dig a little bit deeper into the book, some classic cases, including the 1989 wave of triangles over Belgium. Coming back with more from David Marler. In a moment, we're going to talk about the year 1989, and I remember it well because I had taken the deep dive into the UFO subject that year, producing a multi-part series, working on it for 8 months, 9 months or so. And right in the middle of it, there was a wave of UFO sightings over Belgium, these gigantic triangles, which caught our attention and caught the attention of the Belgian military. So what were those things? A lot of people suspected it might be some sort of a secret American project, a demonstration of technology. Well, David Marler's done some work on that. We're going to get his opinion right after this on Coast to Coast AM. David, a word about sources. You have this incredible library and files that include the materials gathered by early UFO investigative organizations, APRO, BUFORA, things that I don't think BUFORA still exists. APRO certainly doesn't. Maybe NICAP, but you've acquired files from a lot of different places, from the original investigations of the incidents that you included in your book.
Absolutely. Just recently, in November, I was the recipient of the historic Center for UFO Studies files, which also included the NICAP, historic NICAP case files from Don Kehoe's organization. And so, yes, I've been able to draw from the quite literally the original case files themselves. There's nothing better than going to the actual source, the actual raw case files. And so I'm now acting as curator for those files on behalf of CUFOS. And it does afford me a rare opportunity to have, you know, these data sets to look at, especially when we compare some of these historic cases to the Belgian incident that you were alluding to.
Let's jump into Belgium now. When did it start? What were the first incidents, and how seriously did the Belgians take it?
Right. Well, you know, I became actively involved in UFOs in 1990, so this was one of the hot topics, as you mentioned, in 1989 when you were looking into the subject. November 29th, 1989 really began the wave of sightings of these objects in Belgium. And it was late at night, and it was one of the initial sightings was near the village of Upan, which is near the German border. And interestingly enough, a lot of the witnesses at that hour were, of course, police officers or gendarmerie. And they were observing these triangular platforms with extremely intense lights that were moving silently over the countryside. And in a number of cases, they actually observed late that night, the objects hovering over a dam, the La Galleppe Dam. And they saw beams of light coming down. They saw red balls dropping out of the large triangular objects. And these are characteristics that play out time and time again when you start looking at some of the historical cases. But unlike here in the United States, beyond the dramatic nature of the sightings themselves was the fact that the Belgian military was looking at it. The Belgian Air Force was actively investigating these cases, and they weren't shy about it. They were talking about it on Belgian television. In fact, the one incident that occurred in 91 where four separate NATO ground-based tracking stations were tracking one of these objects after it had been visually sighted by an off-duty police officer who was having an outdoor party in his backyard. They were seeing these objects. Four separate NATO ground stations were tracking an unknown target at that location. And based on all of that confirmation, the Belgian Air Force dispatched two F-16s. The lead F-16, which was piloted by Yves Mielsberg, he actually was able to lock on multiple times with a target. And every time he'd lock on, the object would tear away at blistering speed, not only increasing speed, but decreasing or increasing altitude at extreme rates of climb. And so, you know, what these objects were, we still don't know, but they were reported by hundreds, if not thousands, of Belgian citizens from November 29, 1989, all the way into spring of 1991, where they gradually tapered off. Interesting, though, is when I start looking at the totality of information on this subset of UFOs, George, is the fact that prior to that, there was a wave of sightings in southern England and across the English Channel. And prior to that, there was a wave in 1983 in Wales. So it's almost as if this pattern of activity started in Wales and then shifted over England, over near Southampton, and then very easily jumped the channel, and then we started having these sightings in Belgium. And that's what's interesting about doing the historical research. We can look at these waves or these periods of occurrence as separate and distinct periods of time, but when you start connecting the dots, you start to see shifting patterns of activity, and the Belgian wave was just unprecedented. Now, I became interested in triangles based on that series of sightings, based on the validity of reports coming from the Belgian Air Force, and the fact that these triangles are what I like to call unambiguous UFOs. These aren't little points of light in the sky that are seen for just a fleeting second. These are detailed, structured objects flying at low altitude, and they usually leave a very indelible impression on the witnesses. But fast forward to about 10 years after that, I was living in southern Illinois at the time, and I was the Illinois State Director for MUFON. We had a very similar episode transpire in southern Illinois where we had local police officers in neighboring municipalities citing a large, silent, triangular object with very similar lighting characteristics to that of the Belgian reports, but this was on January 5th, 2000, about 10 years later. And these police officers who weren't into UFOs were sitting in the police station sketching the objects, describing how it flew, how it could hover, stop, could suddenly accelerate in the blink of an eye and disappear. And I'm thinking back to my memory and my knowledge of the Belgian wave, and I found the consistencies in the witnesses, consistencies in the objects and the flight characteristics eerily similar. And it forced me really into this area of research in focusing on the triangles. And I thought to myself, if there's parallels between these two well-documented cases, there must be other parallels looking at other cases in the data. And that's what really launched my very focused effort over about a 10-year period, looking at the triangular UFOs and the historical reports we have on file, which ultimately led to the publication of my book.
Well, it's a great book. It's just a great piece of journalism, and the research is impeccable, as is a characteristic of all the work you do. Back to Belgium for a second. Did the Belgian military, De Brouwer, I think his name was, did they initially suspect that it was us, it was the Americans playing with new toys over their airspace?
Absolutely. And to their credit, you know, much like any credible UFO investigator, we don't jump to the extraterrestrial hypothesis right away. We try to rule out any and all practical explanations. And Colonel De Brouwer, later General De Brouwer, did make inquiries with the United States government as to whether or not we might be flying some type of stealth aircraft over Belgium. I mean, they were, in fact, our NATO partner, but they did make official inquiries, and the answer came back negative. And, you know, and certainly in 1989, 1990, that would be valid considering the B-2 bomber and other military assets that we had at the time. But in absence of any confirmation on the part of U.S. authorities, they were left scratching their heads. And again, many people believe that these modern triangles are some type of military technology that we have, but I would challenge those individuals to look at the historical record. Because whereas some triangles that are being seen today might be military, in other words, seeing a simple triangular object in the air might be the latest development in stealth technology, but the exotic characteristics of some of these triangles, I think, speak to someone else's technology. And by that I mean, George, the ability for these triangles oftentimes to be seen flying with the flat side of the triangle as the leading edge. In other words, if we had triangular aircraft moving with traditional aerodynamic principles, one would think you'd have the point of the triangle as the leading edge, so it can basically, you know, move through the air just like a commercial or standard military aircraft. But what we find are these triangles that often have thickness as well as length and width moving with the flat side as the leading edge. In fact, I've come across just recently some additional accounts from the 1950s and 60s where they're describing that very thing. And I like to say that these triangles moving with the flat side as the leading edge is about as aerodynamic as a brick flying through the air.
You know, and as you've mentioned, they are gigantic. They will fly along silently. They can hover. So you think, well, maybe it's a balloon. And then they sure take off like a bolt of lightning, which, you know, we don't have craft that do that that we know of.
No, and actually some skeptics have put forth the idea that maybe these are some type of stealth blimp, which was circulated in like popular mechanics, popular science around 2000. It was speculated that we had this vehicle. And I would concede that, okay, maybe some of the reports are, if they're seen moving slowly or hovering, I could easily acknowledge that could be a blimp or some type of lighter-than-air vehicle. But when you have, as I interviewed these police officers on January 5th, 2000, the sighting that they had, the object was literally hovering almost directly above this one police officer, and I was on location interviewing him where he had the sighting. He said one minute it was hovering there, and then there was a flash, and the object suddenly streaked to the southwest. And we calculated where that officer was, where the police officer that then saw it literally seconds later were. We calculated the distance, we calculated the speed, and we also had the time index on the radio broadcast with St. Clair County Dispatch. So we had all the date, we had the time, we had the locations, and this object clearly went supersonic Yet there was no sonic boom, which, of course, we hear with many other UFO reports, such as the Tic Tac and more modern reports. But more specifically, you know, you have this object that accelerated rapidly after hovering. Now, certainly a lighter-than-air vehicle can hover. It can move slowly. But they do not have the rigid framework to sustain that type of G-force as it's moving through the air.
What about photographic evidence? I know I can remember there's a classic photo. I think it might even be multicolored lights on the bottom of it. Is that pretty much it, or is there more that I don't know about?
Yeah, the famous Belgian photo that was taken during that wave has pretty much been debunked or discounted based on the group that investigated that series of sightings. And I know Patrick Farin, who is one of the lead investigators, he actually led the investigations, was one of the lead investigators on that entire series of investigations. And unfortunately, it seems that that photo had been debunked, that the individual had in fact hoaxed it. And of course, the ubiquitous skeptics latch onto that and say, well, see, the photo was fake, therefore none of these sightings are valid, which is a gross overgeneralization to summarily discount all the sightings just because one person hoaxed a photo. But there's lots of photos and videos circulating on the internet. I always shy away from those, though, George, not because I'm not interested in them, but I always simply state when people send me videos or photos, I'm not a photographic expert or a video expert. You know, I would have to enlist the aid of someone that specializes in that area, because I can tell you what my feelings are regarding it, but I simply don't have the technical expertise to dissect and really properly vet those photos and videos.
I get the same stuff every day, every single day, and I have the same response. Look, I am a nitwit when it comes to tech or a photo analysis or video. Yeah, right. What about documentation from both sides of the ocean? Is there a Belgian FOIA? And if so, what records are there? And then same question for this side. Does our Department of Defense have any FOIA-able records that reflect on what happened back then? I know you use FOIA a lot, so wondering.
I have. I haven't used it for any of the triangular reports, though, because, again, the Belgian Air Force was pretty forthcoming with a lot of their investigation and their notes and their conclusions. I have gone through the Project Blue Book files, the British Ministry of Defense UFO files. They had numerous triangular reports from the late 80s all the way into the 1990s. In fact, there was an incident that played out, which I write about in my book, where a 737 was coming in from Madrid landing at Manchester Airport. And this was one of the more dramatic triangular cases on record in the MOD files. And as the pilot and co-pilot were basically making final approach heading towards Manchester Airport, this triangular object nearly collided with their commercial aircraft. It literally flew right off their wingtip and barely missed them. One pilot stated he even braced for impact because he thought it was going to hit them. And they clearly saw this thing streak past their aircraft. The CAA, which is the equivalent of our FAA in England, launched a one-year investigation, and in the MOD files, you can actually read their final report, which basically, source of the object unknown, and the rationale for it being where it was unknown. They were literally left scratching their heads at odds trying to figure out what this thing was, but it really speaks to the larger issue when we talk about UFOs. There's this whole issue of air safety. You know, we think that we have controlled airspace with commercial and military aircraft, but clearly we don't if we have these objects flying with impunity through these quote-unquote controlled airspaces.
You have a case that is not a triangle. It's you describe it as a flying jellyfish from 1954. Can you recall the details on that one?
Absolutely. That was one that garnered a lot of international media attention. Captain James Howard was the pilot of a British Overseas Airway cruiser that was flying from New York up to Nova Scotia, I believe. And he and the first officer, Lee Boyd, saw this object that they could clearly see. It was a dark, large object. And on each side, on the left side and the right side, were three smaller objects flanked on the left side and the right side. The passengers saw this. The stewardess, Daphne Webster, I believe was her name, also was watching this. They watched it for 15 minutes while they were flying, and the objects almost seemed to be flying parallel with them. Now, they called it a flying jellyfish because the object kept morphing and changing shape, the parent object, if you will, the central object. At one point, it looked like an antique telephone receiver turned upside down. At another point, it looked like a dumbbell. But at one point, Captain Howard sketched in his logbook that it looked like a black triangle. Now, what's interesting about this is at one point during this 15-minute period, Captain Howard's attention got diverted. I forget what had distracted him. It was something to do with the flight or with, you know, I think he was actually telling Daphne Webster, make sure the passengers remain calm if they get nervous, if they see this thing. When he turns back, he notices the small objects on the left and the right side of this parent object had disappeared. And he asked Officer Lee Boyd, the first officer, he goes, where did the small objects go? And Lee Boyd responded with, it looked like they went into the large central object. Now, what's interesting about that, George, is I found something that was the exact opposite. There was a sighting in a Reuters News Service article from April 1958 and in Denmark where a woman in the village of Brohir described a dark, silent, large, triangular object hovering over the village. Reuters confirmed in the article that they talked to 20 other villagers who confirmed the eyewitness's testimony. They also saw this object. But in addition to seeing the object, they saw horseshoe-shaped objects flying out of this large, triangular object. And this is in 1958, April of 1958. And that's one of the characteristics I outlined because, you know, in addition to cataloging these reports, I also created a working profile of the characteristics, very similar to Lou Elizondo's observables. But, you know, these are the common characteristics. One of them is quite often lights and or objects are seen detaching or exiting and entering these large triangles when being observed.
We're talking with David Marler about his excellent book, Triangular UFOs, An Estimate of the Situation. Much more to cover here, some other cases, and then we will be opening up the phone lines to see what's on your mind and touch on some current events as well. We'll be right back